This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians flared again Monday, a day after an apparently botched Israeli undercover operation in Gaza Sunday left 7 Palestinians and an Israeli officer dead. It was the worst violence since the 2014 Gaza War. Sirens wailed across southern Israel as hundreds of rockets and mortar rounds fell from Gaza. Several homes were hit. One person was killed, several wounded. At least 3 people were killed in retaliatory Israeli airstrikes with dozens of targets hit, including the Al-Aqsa television station where paramedics and others sifted through the rubble. Sunday's Israeli undercover operation remains unexplained and comes amid signs of an easing of tensions, according to Randolph-Macon College history professor Michael Fishback.
In the wake of what was seemingly a lot of progress, it is a little surprising to me that Israel chose that moment to launch some sort of attack that, whatever its real motives are, was certainly going to be seen by Hamas as a dangerous escalation.
The flare-up is seen as a setback to mediation efforts by Egypt, Qatar, and the UN to broker a longer-term ceasefire. An Italian-sponsored 2-day summit of Libya's warring factions is underway. Among the participants, Eastern Administration strongman Khalifa Haftar and Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, the UN-backed official based in Tripoli.
L'Italia ha promosso questa conferenza
Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said the meeting in Palermo is designed to boost a UN stabilization process with Libyan factions and officials from 20 nations. The UN had hoped to hold elections in the North African country December 10, but canceled the plan due to violence and stalled negotiations. The country is still largely controlled by armed groups. This is VOA News. The Saudi pro-government coalition resumed airstrikes against Houthi rebel defenders in the Yemeni Red Sea port city of Hodeidah Monday. Turki al-Malki is a coalition spokesman.
The operation is still going, and it's not true that there is a ceasefire in Hodeidah.
Dozens have been killed, including civilians, since the renewed offensive was launched November 1st. In Riyadh, visiting British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt pressed Saudi Arabia for an end to the nearly 4-year war.
The Saudis are willing to play their part in confidence-building measures, but the Houthis also need to do that as well, and that means no more missiles coming in from Yemen into Saudi Arabia, no more drones coming in, because those too are the things that provoke some of these strikes.
The port city remains a key lifeline for millions of malnourished Yemenis. International pressure on Riyadh has increased since the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, October 2nd. The UN Atomic Watchdog Agency says Iran continues to abide by its obligations under the 2015 nuclear agreement despite last May's U.S. withdrawal and reimposition of sanctions. The International Atomic Energy Agency said Tehran's reserves of low-enriched uranium remained well below the deal's 202.8-kilogram limit, while its stock of heavy water is virtually unchanged. Rohingya community leaders said those on a list set to be repatriated this week to Myanmar, also known as Burma, have fled from camps in Bangladesh. Some 700,000 Rohingya fled a crackdown by security forces the UN likened to ethnic cleansing, including massacres, burned villages, and gang rapes. UN spokesman Farhan Haq Monday said those on the list should be allowed to first visit before deciding whether to return.
The refugees reportedly verified by Myanmar as having the right to return should be allowed to visit their places of origin in Rakhine State or other places to which they might choose to return.
Rights groups and the UN Refugee Agency expressed doubt conditions are safe for their return. Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau said talks are underway with Pakistan over offering asylum to Christian mother Asia Bibi and her family after her acquittal of violating the country's blasphemy laws. She's been incarcerated for 8 years before the Supreme Court ruling earlier this month. In Ethiopia, dozens of security officials appeared in court Monday, suspected of corruption and rights abuses, and after the Attorney General accused security chiefs of planning a grenade attack targeting Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. He's the country's first Oromo leader who has embarked on a series of reforms. Since taking office in April, no charges have been filed. Stan Lee, creator of a long list of Marvel comic book superheroes such as Spider-Man, Iron Man, the Hulk, and Black Panther, died Monday in California at age 95. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An international conference to stabilize Libya gets underway today in Italy.
The conference in the Sicilian capital of Palermo was expected to begin Monday evening with a private dinner hosted by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte.
That's correspondent Sabina Castelfranco in Rome. One of Nigeria's female presidential candidates will discuss her solutions to some of the monstrous challenges that she says facing the country. Malawi is enforcing travel restrictions on cabinet ministers, and charges of propagating false information against the state have been dropped against a female Cameroon journalist.
We are hoping that in the days to come, the other journalists will finally be free. That is the kind of Cameroon that we want. A Cameroon where journalists will be able to tell the story without being reprimanded by the government, without being reprimanded by the opposition.
Mimi Mifo is a journalist with the privately owned Equinox Media Group of Cameroon, and two Jewish cemeteries have been rededicated in Cape Verde's Santo Antio Island. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Italy is hosting an international conference on Libya in an effort to find ways to bring about stability to the North African country, which has been beset by chaos and violence in 2011. As Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome, it is not clear whether everyone with a stake in Libya's future will show up.
The conference in the Sicilian capital of Palermo was expected to begin Monday evening with a private dinner hosted by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Ahead of the plenary sessions Tuesday, it was not clear whether all the main factions involved in Libya would attend. One major player, General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the self-styled Libyan National Army that controls much of eastern Libya, has reportedly said the conference lacks a clear agenda. In an interview with La Stampa newspaper, the Italian Prime Minister said he expected Haftar to be present. Italy had hoped US President Donald Trump, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel would attend, but they will not be there. Lower-ranking officials are representing those countries. Nonetheless, Italy wants to keep the focus on the OPEC producer, where chaos has reigned for 7 years among the hundreds of rival armed groups and tribes since Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed. Italy wants to help find a way to overcome the divisions in Libya. Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio told reporters last week he was confident that a shared roadmap for the stabilization of the North African country could be drawn up. Di Maio said it was very important to receive the support of the United States as Italy takes the lead in managing and stabilizing Libya. He said Rome is doing so with the highest level of commitment and hoping to achieve the highest level of results. Di Maio said no one would be excluded from supporting Italy along this road. Libya is currently run by two administrations, a weak UN-backed government of national accord run by Fayez al-Sarraj in the capital of Tripoli, and another one in the eastern part of the country headed by Haftar. Al-Sarraj had hoped elections would be held in December, following discussions at a summit in France earlier this year, but this plan was abandoned due to Libya's volatile state. Italy and France, which both have strong business ties in Libya, have also appeared to be rivals rather than work together in efforts to end the current state of affairs in the North African country. Conte has denied this, saying that both Rome and Paris have a common interest in stabilizing the nation. Libya is also a departure point for migrants who seek to escape war and poverty and head for European shores. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
One of the female candidates in Nigeria's 2019 presidential election says she is the candidate to beat in the February poll because she's the candidate of all Nigerians. Obiageli Ezekwesili, standard bearer of the Allied Congress Party of Nigeria, on Monday released what she calls the seven monstrous challenges that she says are holding Nigeria's development back. They include too little productivity and competitiveness of the Nigerian economy, too much poverty and inequality, and too much insecurity and conflict, among others. Dr. Ezekwesili explains to me how she would address each of these challenges if elected president, starting with productivity and competitiveness.
A key part of addressing Nigeria's productivity problem is to address the barriers that stand in the way of productivity, and barriers go from the quality of labor, the capacity of labor, to the issues of infrastructure deficit and matters of bureaucratic and regulatory stifling processes and procedures and expectations.
It's kind of heartbreaking to hear you talk about too much poverty and inequality in Nigeria. Especially that country is it's a wealthy country. It has resources. So what would you do if you became president? How would you bring the rest of Nigeria on board to benefit from the resources of the country?
To tackle the problems of poverty in Nigeria, we must rebalance the economy such that our economic philosophy is no longer confused as to where growth comes from. We will be an administration that focuses on having the private sector be at the center of our economy. The private sector will drive the engine of growth. And as growth happens, we make sure that it is growth that is broad-based, that is inclusive, that is shared. The fastest way to take people out of poverty is to enable them earn income. Jobs, and more jobs through the private sector.
One of those monstrous challenges you mentioned is that of insecurity and conflict. And one of the issues that I think is contributing to the insecurity is the Boko Haram situation. So how would you deal with that if you were the president?
There are many approaches to dealing with the sharp and acute state of fragility that country faces. The first thing is to stop the bleeding. We will embark swiftly on the intense overhaul of our security sector to ensure that we can take it back to levels of professionalism and accountability that would enable us to have a better surveillance of our neighborhood and our territory. Our domestic policing has suffered a lot of devaluation of the import of our police and law enforcement. We will focus on the necessary reforms that will bring them back to form.
Obiageli Ezekwesili is the presidential candidate of the Allied Congress Party of Nigeria. She was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Malawian protocol demands that cabinet ministers and senior members of government on official assignment overseas seek permission from the office of the president before traveling. Presidential spokesman Mgeme Kalilani says the purpose is to save money. His remark came after Embattled Vice President Solos Chilima announced he will be traveling abroad ahead of next year's general election. Local media said the vice president, who has recently fallen out with the president, did not inform President Peter Mutharika about his travels. VOA's Peter Clottis spoke with presidential spokesman Kalilani.
As far as the office of the president is concerned, we haven't received any application for leave or any notification from the vice president that he has been going to attend to some international engagement. We have just been reading about them in the media like anyone else.
Does that mean that the recent trips that the vice president made to Nigeria, United Arab Emirates, the president was not aware which flout the protocol or the mechanism the president has implemented to monitor these austerity measures?
Definitely, yes. The president was not aware in the sense that he was never informed. And at no any given point, no formal communication from the office of the vice president informing the president about these trips. The president just ends up reading about them in the media like anybody else.
So what was the president's reaction and what is he going to do about this? Because the vice president's office is directed by the president to do what the president wants him to do.
Right. It's a point of concern for the government. You know, the vice president is a very senior office in our government to set up, very senior, such that when the vice president travels, it's a bit logic that you would have a vice president that would elect be going on international trips without informing his superior. But having noted that that is what is happening, obviously, the office of the president will remind the vice president, in case he needs to be reminded, will remind that it is a requirement, an office requirement, a very basic office requirement, that if you work in an office and you're a junior in that particular office, more so, you just have to take leave of your superior when you are to be absent from the office. But anyway, here we are. We are in a situation where the vice president decides not to go by that for reasons best known by himself.
What do you say to critics who are saying that the vice president, who constitutionally and traditionally is a member of cabinet, was surreptitiously excluded from the list of cabinet ministers in the president's cabinet reshuffle recently? So it's the president who, they said, has refused to even mention his name by just referring to him as someone.
Well, perhaps we have to put matters in their proper perspective. The president has not excluded the vice president from the cabinet. The vice president of the Republic of Malawi is a member of the cabinet by virtue of the constitutional order. He doesn't have to take the president to appoint him to the cabinet. In any case, he is not an appointed member of the cabinet. He is there courtesy of the Section 92 of the Malawi Republican Constitution, which says clearly that there shall be a cabinet, and in the cabinet there shall be the president and the vice president and the second vice president, in case you have one, and cabinet ministers and deputy ministers as may be appointed by the president. So the list you're talking about addresses the latter part of this provision, which requires the president to appoint cabinet ministers and deputy ministers. That's what the president did.
Ngemi Kalilani, a spokesman for Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clote from Blantyre. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 13th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. The female journalist who was jailed by Cameroon authorities and released on bail on Saturday says she hopes her case will lead to the release of other Cameroon journalists who are languishing in jails around the country just for doing their job. Mimi Mefo of the privately owned Equinox Television and Radio Media Group returned to court on Monday to face charges of propagating false information against the state. But to her surprise, the Douala Military Tribunal dropped all charges against her. Mefo says she feels relieved now that the charges against her have been dropped. She says Cameroon journalists want to report objectively without being reprimanded by either the government or the opposition.
I think it's a relief because just in a day, finding yourself behind bars, not knowing exactly what you've done to deserve going to jail, and then a few days after you're declared free, I think it's quite relieving.
So what do you make of the charges that were brought against you?
The lawyers are better pleased to see exactly what happened. But according to the charges, I gave information that was not in conformity to the stability, national cohesion that Cameroon has been preaching ever since the Anglophone crisis escalated. Honestly speaking, that was really to the intention of my publication, because a journalist would never put out an information out there that would jeopardize national security. So I didn't see it going up to that extent.
It must be difficult for you, the Cameroonian journalist, covering this insurrection by the self-proclaimed Ambazonia separatist. It must be very difficult.
Very, very difficult indeed, because journalists in Cameroon now, especially indigenous journalists are caught between two smoking guns. You have to play that role of neutrality, which at times is very, very difficult. When you're reporting about military atrocities on the ground, the burning of houses and the killing of civilians, you seem to be an enemy on the side of the military. And when you are reporting about the atrocities of the Ambazonian fighters, those who are fighting for the liberation of southern Cameroon, you seem to be an enemy on the side. So journalists at this point in time, they are actually caught between those two opposing camps. There's equally the problem of getting the right information and the problem of source of information, because at certain point in time, the military is not there to give the official version of the information on time. The Ambazonian fighters is not equally there to accept responsibility, especially when certain atrocities are created.
You know, Mimi, I know of many journalists who have gone to jail for nothing they did wrong. Since you have now joined the club, tell me, what is it like in prison there?
Many journalists, like you said, are actually in jail. We have many, many other journalists that are being persecuted by the government of Cameroon. Others were arrested and later released. Like myself, I was equally arrested and released, and all the charges that were against me have been dropped. That is the situation now in Cameroon. National NGOs and even international NGOs have been fighting for their release. But up to now, the situation has still not changed enough. Mine has been considered as a possibility for all the other journalists that are currently behind bars to finally regain their freedom. And we are hoping that in the days to come, the other journalists that are there will finally be free. That is the kind of Cameroon that we want. A Cameroon where journalists will be able to tell the story, especially balanced story, objective reporting, without being reprimanded by the government, without being reprimanded by the opposition. That is the kind of country that we want.
Mimi, we're so happy to have you on Daybreak Africa, and very nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mimi Menfo is a journalist with the privately owned Equinox Media Group of Cameroon. She was speaking with me from the economic capital, Douala. It seems pressure is mounting on the government of Liberian President George Weah to establish a war crimes court. There was a peaceful protest Monday in the capital, Monrovia, by local civil society groups and their international partners to demand the establishment of the court.
These were the slogans that rented through the streets of the capital Monrovia when a group of Liberians protested Monday night against what they called the culture of impunity. They want the government of President George Weah to establish a special criminal tribunal to prosecute people who allegedly masterminded and committed atrocities during the 14-year Liberian Civil War. Strangely enough, some of the former combatants joined the protest with their own placards, some calling for a war crimes court, justice, and end to impunity, among others.
This country needs justice. Without justice, proper government will not receive sustainable peace.
Justice needs to take a course. And this issue has to do with the establishment of war crimes court in our country is very much important.
Can you believe a human being living again? No sister, no brother. Let me alone. Why did they struggle?
Some of the protesters carried the picture of presumed family members who they said were murdered during the Civil War. The protesters presented petitions to the United Nations, the European Union, the United States Embassy, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and the African Union. Adam Dempster, Secretary General of the Civil Society Human Rights Platform, led the protest.
We want justice for past crimes. We think that after the civil conflict, Liberia have not seen justice. And most of the people who committed these crimes are the most powerful people in Liberia.
Liberia's Deputy Information Minister for Press and Public Affairs, Dujin Fagon, said he was in solidarity with those calling for the establishment of a war crimes court in Liberia.
Well, let me say this to you. Quite frankly, justice should be served to everyone. Justice does not have a particular time.
The Liberian legislature has the constitutional duty to craft a law establishing a special criminal tribunal to prosecute those who allegedly committed heinous crimes during the Liberian civil crisis. But recently, at a one-day justice conference, Representative Rosalind Swakogodenis, Chair of Claims and Petition at the House of Representatives, said legislators were waiting for details about the war crimes court before crafting a law. In 2009, the Liberia Truth and Reconciliation Commission, after conducting a nationwide hearing, made over 200 recommendations, including the prosecution of those who bore the greatest responsibilities for the atrocities committed during the Civil War that claimed about 250,000 lives. Another group of Liberians, including some in the George Weah administration, have called for a national referendum on the establishment of a war crimes court. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
Two Jewish cemeteries were rededicated in Cape Verde last week as part of an effort to remember and celebrate Jewish heritage in Cape Verde. The Cape Verde Jewish Heritage Project works to honor the memory of the Sephardic Jews who immigrated to Cape Verde in the 19th century. Part of honoring that memory is to restore and preserve Jewish cemeteries. The project's president, Carol Castillo, tells Ricky Shryak.
Cape Verde is a multicultural country. Sephardic Jews, Jews from Morocco, immigrated here in the 19th century. So they're part and parcel of Cape Verdean identity. And I found out over the years that there were cemeteries in this island, Santo Antão. So this is the island where the large majority of the Jews, you know, migrated and lived and did business. There are two cemeteries, one in Ponta do Sol and one in Penha da França. And they were in a dilapidated condition. And it's important. It's important to preserve their memory, document their legacy. Cape Verdeans want to do this. I just picked up on it to be able to help them. Hopefully it's for the best because it helped to remind people that these Jews from Morocco and Gibraltar were part and parcel and are, and their descendants, part and parcel of Cape Verdean identity and history.
When I was there, I thought I was told that it's not just Moroccan Jews as well. There were Jews that came over from Europe even before that, correct? Cape Verde and the Jewish community actually have quite a long-standing relationship. Is that correct?
It depends on how you interpret it. You know, there were new Christians possibly in the time of the Portuguese up until the Inquisition. They wouldn't be practicing Jews because they weren't allowed to be. I mean, up until 1821, there was an Inquisition, and this was the Portuguese colony. I understand that a lot of people think, well, I have Jewish ancestry, but these Jews who came in the 19th century, the only Jews who came openly practicing their religion, they created burial grounds. Our organization, the Verde Jewish Heritage Project, was created to help preserve the burial ground of the Jews who came in the 19th century, who already came as practicing Jews, and they came from Morocco and Gibraltar.
Are there any efforts to teach this history in, like, local schools and things like that?
Well, that's precisely the other reason why, you know, we're doing this, in order to document the history and legacy of these Jews. Cape Verde Jewish Heritage Project has a historian. Her name is Angela Sofia Benoliel Cuchinho, and she is writing a book at this as we speak.
Do you think also making sure people know about this shared history from the immigration to the assimilation to everything in between is important for the future of Cape Verde in general, promoting tolerance and just knowing that everyone has these different varied backgrounds, but all living on the same island archipelago at this time?
Yeah, exactly. There's no question that another reason why it's important that we not only preserve these cemeteries and document the history of these mostly Moroccan Jews who came to Cape Verde in the 19th century in and of itself, but it's also important to demonstrate how Cape Verde has always been a very tolerant and multicultural, multi-religious country, particularly multi-racial, multi-ethnic. And these Sephardic Jews, these Jews of Morocco, are part and parcel of that. And it's a very important lesson today to perpetuate that sense of tolerance and openness, that the Jews were welcome back in the 19th century, and their legacy lives on in these cemeteries, the presence of these cemeteries, which we are currently restoring and hopefully maintaining in perpetuity.
That was Carol Castile, president of the Cape Verde Jewish Heritage Project. She was speaking with Ricky Shryak. And that is it for this Tuesday, November 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.